ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरान्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपः कदा मह्यं ददाति स्वपदान्तिकं वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरोः श्रीयुतपदकमलं श्रीगुरुन् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहगणरघुनाथान्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादां सहगणललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च हे कृष्णकरुणासिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिकाकान्त राधाकान्त नमोऽस्तु ते तप्तकाञ्चन गौराङ्गी राधे वृन्दावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरे प्रिये वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुभ्य एव च पतितानां भावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभो नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे
You have Bhagavad Gita?
We can begin with a verse from Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. His edition is aptly entitled Bhagavad Gita as it is, because although there were many editions of Bhagavad Gita published even when Srila Prabhupada arrived in the United States in 1965, very few of them actually represented the real spirit of the text. The problem is that it's not so easy to recognize that unless you know what the spirit of the text is. And not many people take the time and trouble to acquaint themselves with Bhagavad Gita firsthand. We were describing last night with regards to chapter 4, text 10 of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna mentions Bohovo gnana tapasa puta madbhavam agataha. Many people in the past, he said, became purified by the austerity of knowledge. And according to Ramanujacharya, the great Vaishnava Acharya from South India, that means Krishna is referring to those who take the trouble to acquaint themselves with Bhagavad Gita and to really enter into the spirit of the text itself. Anyway, whether by sentiment or whatever other impetus, thank you. In 1975, I decided to acquaint myself with Bhagavad Gita by learning Sanskrit. I wanted to understand, without all the hype, what is Krishna actually trying to say. And I, at that time, had the concept that learning the language might be have some help there. But really, it's not so. In several places through the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, or he implies at least, that it's through bhakti that one understands the text. At least in the end of chapter 18, Krishna says very clearly, bhaktya tvananyaya, or bhaktya mabhivijanati yavanyaschasmi tatvataha. Ityadi means that one can really understand me as I am only through bhakti. And that's confirmed elsewhere throughout the Gita. He says, manmana bhava madbhakto madhyaji man namaskuru, etc. Twice he says that. Just become my devotee, just bow down to me, just worship me. Just think, keep your mind focused on me. This is how we enter into the spirit of Bhagavad Gita ultimately. But even through academic study of the text, it becomes undeniable that bhakti is the supreme path. In chapter 12 in particular, which is entitled Devotional Service, it's one of the shortest chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. Many people memorize it. Anyone here memorize chapter 12? No. Anyway, therein, Arjuna actually directly asks Krishna, if we have questions about spiritual life, they're not going to be answered unless we ask them. And that's exactly what Arjuna does. He's very proactive. Krishna, he's listening to Krishna say so many things in Bhagavad Gita, and if he finds something that's confusing or that it doesn't sound right, he expresses this directly, and he asks Krishna to clarify. So in chapter 12, he's doing this when he is, he's doing this when he asks Krishna, Evam satati yukta ye bhaktas tvam pariyupasate ye chapyaksharam avyaktam tesham ke yoga vittama. Arjuna inquired, which are considered to be more perfect? Those who are always properly recognized, properly engaged in your devotional service, or those who worship the impersonal, Brahman, the unmanifested? We often hear of this nirakara panth, or nirguna. Sometimes they have the idea of nirguna bhakti, especially in North India. So that's what he's talking about. Arjuna was also acquainted with these ideas. Saguna versus nirguna. Is God a person or is he not a person? So he's asking Krishna to clarify directly. What's the answer to this? Krishna says immediately, Mayyaveshyamano Mam Nityukta Upasate Shradhaya Parayopetas Te Me Yukta Tamamata. I consider them to be the most properly engaged, who fix their minds on my personal form and are always engaged in worshipping me with great and transcendental faith. So this is the immediate and direct answer to Arjuna's question, but to give the devil his due, so to speak, Krishna continues, but, whenever there's but, that means something else is coming. Yetu aksharam anirdeshyam avyaktam pariyupasate sarvatra gamachintyam cha kutastham achalam dhruvam saniyam yendriya gramam sarvatra samabuddhayah te prapnuvanti mameva sarvabhuta hiteratah. But those who fully worship the unmanifested, that which lies beyond the perception of the senses, the all-pervading, inconceivable, unchanging, fixed and immovable, the impersonal conception of the Absolute Truth, by controlling the various senses and being equally disposed to everyone, such persons, engaged in the welfare of all, at last achieve me. And then he goes on, Klesho adhikataraste sham avyakta sakta chetasam avyakta higadir dukham dehavad piravapyate. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme Advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. Yetu sarvani karmani, again another but here. Yetu sarvani karmani mayi sanyasya matparaha ananyenaiva yogena mam dhyayant upasate Tesham aham samuddharta mritya samsara sagarat bhavamina chirat partha mayyaveshita chetasam. But those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me, and being devoted to me without deviation, engaged in devotional service, and always meditating upon me, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Pritha, for them I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. Then conclusively, he says in text number 8 here, this is halfway through the chapter, Mayyeva mana adhatsva mayi buddhim naveshaya nivasishyasi mayyeva ata urham na sanshayaha. Just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engage all your intelligence in me. Thus you will live in me always, without a doubt. Any questions so far? It sounds as if Krishna's kind of accommodating both of them, doesn't it? But it's pretty clear, if statistics are what decide such things, that he prefers the devotional path. I mean, he does return to that at least three times, as far as I can tell, whereas he only mentions the impersonal path once or twice. You had some comment?
When Krishna refers to himself as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, how is it given in the Sanskrit verse?
Okay. In the last verse, you mean?
Yeah,
text number 8. Mayi, it's oblique. He says in me.
Just mayi.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So in Sanskrit, the recipient of emotion, like love, is always in locative case. So atishtan.
That is true.
Yes.
But it doesn't say Supreme Person, me, because
it's not explicit in the text because it's indirect. It's oblique. It can't be, yeah.
Actually, in that verse, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says Mayi means Shamasundar.
Yeah, so I mean, that's...
Well,
that's
himself.
This is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on this verse.
It's more personal, isn't it? Shamasundar is opposed to...
Well, of course, we would expect Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur to say that. How about Shankaracharya? He probably says something else. Now, just one thing to consider, folks. There are many, many ways of understanding the Bhagavad Gita. We know this. There are many different interpretations of Bhagavad Gita. But all of them agree on at least one point, which is that at the end of the day, or at the end of the discussion, rather, Arjuna is going to fight. Right? He's going to do what Krishna asked him to do. At least that suggests that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Otherwise, why would Arjuna surrender to what he's asking him to do? We see how disturbed he is in the first few chapters, and yet he will accept this instruction. Karishye vachanam tava, he says, I'm going to do what you say. So anyway, how do we recognize then impersonal philosophy? Because according to Srila Rupa Goswami, what is the definition of Srila Rupa Goswami according to Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu? What is the definition of bhakti? Jnana karmadi anavratam. This is an interesting point. He says, bhakti means devotion unto the Supreme Lord that is devoid of any tinge of fruitive work, that is to say, some interest for myself, for ourselves. Selfish action, that is to say. Or even the idea of escaping, or the idea of becoming liberated from suffering, because this world entails so much suffering. We come here, we try to exploit all of Krishna's things and all of his creatures as well, and then when we make a whole mess of it and have to suffer as a result, naturally, then we try to escape through some philosophical loophole. Karl Potter, here in the University of Washington, my teacher in logic, he said, he calls this, in one of his books, leap philosophy. You just leap out of the situation, and then you're free from it. So that's, in effect, what is so appealing about the Mayavad proposal, because Mayavad in particular, but impersonalism in general, it actually offers one this hope of, and we all know that hope springs eternal, it offers one the hope of... escaping. The desire for liberation is the desire to escape responsibility. So we do two things when we come into this world. We try to exploit Krishna's energies, that means his dull matter as well as his living parts and parcels. Or sometimes we even try to exploit Krishna himself. What's that called? That's called sahajiya mentality. It's quite bigger. It's a more universal human tendency than the namesake, which is an obscure Bengali sect, which is dying out at any rate. So, we try to exploit him or his energies, or if failing that, then we try to at least escape. through liberation, through non-devotional gyan, through non-devotional knowledge or non-devotional spiritual awareness of some sort, but not involving Krishna. These are the two things that everybody does in this material world. And Rupa Goswami says, bhakti, or the effort to really serve Krishna in purity, is devoid of all these things. Now that's ironic, because at the same time, bhakti consists of nothing but karma and gyan. But it is karma of a transcendental sort, as he mentions in chapter 4. Janma karma cha me divyam, divya karma. Or as we sing every day at Guru Puja, divya gyan hride prakashito, in Bengali language. The spiritual master, through this process, he fills our heart with transcendental knowledge. So karma and gyan, they have their transcendental application. That is to say, the things that we naturally, as human beings, naturally aspire for, particularly karma, more than gyan, because most people are more interested in karma than they are in gyan. Of course, nowadays, this has to be qualified, because nowadays people don't even know what karma is. Strictly speaking, they only know vikarma. And there are three aspects to activity that are described in Bhagavad Gita. One of them is karma, which means dharma, the pious activity enjoined in Shastra. The other one is vikarma, means anything other than that. And then in devotional service, we have what Krishna calls akarma. That is to say, it's beyond this whole thing. It's not pious or impious. Neither is it aimed solely at liberation. Rather, it's only aimed at pleasing Krishna. That's why Rupa Goswami can say there's no gyan involved here. Gyan, what is the ultimate goal of gyan? It is liberation. Anybody recognize the name George Wald? Those who are older might know. He was in the previous generation, a very renowned Nobel laureate physicist, nuclear physicist. He won the Nobel Prize back in the day. In the maturity of his career, he gave up speculation because he had reached the end of what speculation can do, for one. He came to the point that Krishna describes in chapter 7, text 19. Bahunam janmanam ante gyanavan mam prapadyate. He recognized that I've got to go beyond this. I need to depend on some higher, superior being that I cannot control or figure out on my own. He recognized the need for mercy, and therefore he began to chant Hare Krishna. George Walsh.
Under the guidance of, he used to come to the Bhaktivedanta Institute, the colloquia and so on.
Yeah.
That is very noble person.
Yeah, he was an honest and progressive person. And in this day and age, all you really have to be is honest and progressive, and you will get there. Because Krishna promises. Krishna promises in Bhagavad Gita that for those who are devoted to me, I give them the Dadami Buddhi Yogam. He says, I give whatever they require. So, when we're trying to cultivate this bhakti, we have to recognize that these two foes exist in the realm of mundane karma and non-devotional gyan. Because sometimes gyan is considered to be, I mean, spiritual gyan, that is, not just ordinary mundane knowledge, but because mundane knowledge, according to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, is actually not knowledge at all. It's actually ignorance. He describes knowledge in several verses, but we don't need to go into that. So, gyan is the tendency to get out of the reactions of our own fruitive misdeeds without Krishna. Krishna says in the 11th canto, Bhayam dvitiya bhinivesha syat. When we turn away from Krishna and seek something else, something dvitiya, something second, then we have to become fearful at every stage. And in order to escape that apprehension about what's coming next, because we never know, what kind of tests are awaiting you 2 weeks away from now? Do you know? No. What are you going to be in your next life? Do you know? Unless you're really determined, you probably don't. So gyan means we're trying to escape the reactions of our many mistakes and our many poor choices in general. So the ultimate and most appealing form that we find in some sort of incarnation nowadays is we call it Mayavad illusionism, because it was taught originally by Shankaracharya, but even his line has more or less died out, and it was adopted in the early 20th century, late 19th century and early 20th century by those Indians very eager to imitate the British that educated them, such as Aurobindo Ghosh and Vivekananda and Annie Besant, well, she's not Indian, but, you know, Jiddu Krishnamurti and so many others who were, they redefined Hinduism. What we know as Hinduism in this day and age is actually the brainchild of this generation, who were mainly, if you'll notice the correlation here, they were mainly involved in Indian independence struggle. Why? Well, let's first rewind a little bit. Back in the early 18th century, and especially in the late 18th and early 19th century, the British introduced a system of education which was intended to subjugate the Indians for good. And it also had the subtextual agenda of undermining faith of the Indian population in all things Indian. All Indians still suffer from this mentality, in case you haven't noticed. So, it was very insidious, and it was a deliberate plan, it would seem, because it was people like Max Müller and other Western, chiefly Western Orientalists, who privileged the position of Shankaracharya far beyond the position of authority that he ever enjoyed in really traditional Hinduism. Think about the math here. The in Vedanta, because we're talking about Vedanta, the real meaning of the Vedas is only in Vedanta. Others are not so concerned about ultimate meaning. Other of the six traditional schools, that is, of Hinduism. What are they? Just to enumerate, they are karma, which means pious ritual especially. They are Vedanta, which is what we're talking about. There's also Nyaya, and then there's atomism, and then there's Sankhya philosophy, and then there's yoga practice. These are the six traditional darshans. But within Vedanta, there are many, many interpretations of Vedanta, and as we mentioned earlier, there are many ways to interpret Bhagavad Gita. Why would the British somehow choose Shankaracharya as the pope, as it were, of all Hinduism, as the representative or the spokesman of all Hinduism? Because Shankaracharya was teaching a philosophy that actually undermined people's faith in Hinduism. And it was very politically convenient for the British at that time, because the Indian independence struggle was very much wrapped up in the early days with the sense of Indian-ness, Indian identity, and particularly Hindu identity. You will recall that what is his name? Qaid-e Azam founded Pakistan. Jinnah. You know, Gandhi and Jinnah had these. I mean, Gandhi had the idea to unify, but Jinnah had the idea all along of separation. One generalist put it very nicely: Islam has jagged borders wherever it goes. Another person put it even more pointedly, maybe, when he said, if not all Muslims are terrorists, then why is it that all terrorists are Muslims?
I don't agree with that.
Almost all of them. Maybe nowadays, but they've...
For a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's an eternal tendency, of course, but in today's world, they're the primary. Anyway, so there are many opinions on that, perhaps. But the idea is that most of the Indian independence freedom fighters. They were tied up with this rubric of Indian sense of identity as Indians, and they were very much trying to link that with Dharma. In fact, Gandhi's whole persona was a very conscious effort to do that. He had this whole sadhu kind of the image that he very artfully crafted for that purpose. Anyway, the real point is this, that the British were very fond of Shankaracharya because his philosophy allowed them to, in effect, teach the Indians that you are not concerned about the things of this world. You don't care about karma because that's all maya. Your concern is gyan. You want liberation. You want out of this material world. So let us run your country for you, since you're not interested in it anyways, and you can go and seek liberation. That was very convenient for them. Of course, there are philosophical aspects that are to be considered as well. But the point is that out of, say, 5 or 6 major Vedanta schools, Shankaracharya is only one of them, and he's not the oldest. Before Shankaracharya was at least Vishnu Swami, according to our Gaudiya Vaishnava charges at least. So there are four or five schools of Vedanta that posit Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and only Shankaracharya says, yes, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but his body is made out of maya. So that's Mayavad. Now the problem is that, as I was saying earlier, that everything we know about modern Hinduism, it kind of regurgitates this ideology in a new and a streamlined form, according to A.L. Dasham, the Indian Indologist. Made a very easily digestible form of the same old ideology, but they say in terms of one Murugi mission in Bengal, Chaitanya's Pat Shankar's Mat. That means that they adopt the kirtan process of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but they prefer the ideology of Shankaracharya. So all these forms of Hinduism, practically everything you can find, it has its ideological roots in the teachings of Shankaracharya, but it's been very much watered down and streamlined and in various ways made consistent with the process of sense gratification. Even sinful sense gratification, because after all, if everything is an illusion, then the distinction between piety and impiety, between virtue and sin, becomes erased also, doesn't it? It's all one. That's the insidious effect of Shankar's philosophy, which was recognized even by Madhvacharya, who was nearly his contemporary. He predicted in his day that if this philosophy is allowed to spread, then it's only going to be the undoing of Dharma throughout the entire world. And that's largely come to pass. As if Shankaracharya were the transcendentally accredited agent of Kali Yuga decadence through his insidious ideology, which the Puranas actually call a Prachanna Bodha, veiled Buddhism. So it's very difficult to recognize because it's hiding under the guise of so many other paths, so many other traditions and so many other teachings, and now we have yoga groups and spiritual masters of various sorts, and they're all teaching more or less the same idea, but we recognize it when we hear statements that say, for example, it's not the one politician wrote in his commentary on Bhagavad Gita. It's not actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead to whom you have to surrender. It's the eternal, unborn, impersonal something within Krishna. So actually the teachings of the Shastra is that there's no distinction between Krishna's inside and his outside. He doesn't have a body made of mundane elements. His body is made of Satchidananda. He's within all of our hearts. And he has his own name, he has his form, he has his associates, all of his activities. And Bhakti Yoga is meant to uncover the dormant love within our hearts such that we can actually recognize that. Because we're not going to recognize it as long as we're entertaining misconceptions about whether or not that's the goal. You're not going to recognize it. So it's very subtle, and that's what makes it pernicious, I should say. Because ultimately Krishna is, one of my godbrothers wrote a commentary on Bhagavad Gita as well, and he emphasizes the fact that Krishna is really trying to join or rejoin, to have all the conditioned souls in this material world rejoin with him in pure love, in a loving relationship. And if we become familiar with the text of the Bhagavad Gita, which is why Prabhupada translated it very faithfully according to the teachings of the great acharyas, not those who have concocted business-friendly, streamlined reinterpretations of Shankaracharya's ideology. But according to the bona fide acharyas, Srila Prabhupada has given his translation, and his purports largely paraphrase those of, of his predecessors. So he called it Bhagavad Gita as it is, as opposed to Bhagavad Gita as it isn't, or as somebody else wants it to be. So it takes some familiarity with the text. We should read Bhagavad Gita. And not only read Bhagavad Gita, but also chant Krishna's holy name, as Krishna advises himself in the Bhagavad Gita. Satatam kirtayanto mam. If you want to be a Mahatma, real Mahatma doesn't mean a politician dressed as a sadhu, but rather a person who's actually chanting Krishna's name constantly. Satatam kirtayantaha. These are the Krishna's own words. We cannot ignore them. That's what it means to be a Mahatma. So if we chant Krishna's name in this way, then our hearts become purified to the extent that we can understand what we become familiar with in the Bhagavad Gita. Otherwise, the tendency of the mundane mind, the conditioned and especially sinful minds, is to twist and twangle whatever meaning is expedient out of the text for our nefarious designs, either in the realm of karma or the realm of jnana, as the case may be. That's what always has happened. Therefore, we saw, it's already documented in history, that out of so many editions that existed before Srila Prabhupada prepared his Bhagavad Gita as it is, there were so many scores of editions of Bhagavad Gita in the English language alone, what to speak of others, but they didn't create a single devotee. They didn't create a single devotee. I myself read Bhagavad Gita before I came to ISKCON, and I didn't understand Bhagavad Gita. I understand now that the reason I didn't understand the Bhagavad Gita that I read is because the person who translated it didn't understand it either. Because evam parampara praptam imam raja rishayo viduhu. Krishna ne kaha. He says in the Bhagavad Gita also that this science is received in disciplic succession. If you don't receive it through guru parampara, you're getting something which is somebody's business plan, or you're getting something which is somebody's political agenda, or you're getting something that's somebody's ego trip, but you're not getting Bhagavad Gita as it is. This is the point. It's not party policy of the International Society of Krishna Consciousness to push this idea. It's coming directly in the text. Just read it. It's in black and white. So, but we have to understand that it's ultimately not just dependent on knowledge. It really does depend on purity of the heart, purity of one's intention. Suhrit satam vidhunoti, Krishna says, or Bhagavatam says. Also in the 11th canto it's there as well. So, means that when we are sincere and serious and mainly honest, then the enlightenment will come. That's why we need to chant the holy name. It disinfects the infection that has overrun our hearts. And even we read Srila Prabhupada's books, they do not resonate with us unless there's some purity there that it can get through. The Kashmir Shaivas have a very nice word, pratyabhijna. Pratyabhijna means recognition. When you hear something, you have to recognize it. That's what faith means. Faith means we hear something and we recognize, yes, I know this. It's true. I believe this. And then we want to hear something more. That's a natural process, but it depends on some tiny speck of honesty. In this day and age, it's said that honesty is really the only thing that's keeping the bull of Dharma standing, and only then on one leg. It's honesty. If we don't have that, we're not going anywhere. Therefore, chanting of Sankirtan is so important. So important that when we were all asleep at the wheel, Krishna arranged to somehow popularize Kirtan right under our own noses through other people. So, anyway, the Mayavad philosophy can attack our understanding of Bhagavad Gita in various ways because it is very subtle. It's extremely subtle. It really takes a lot of experience. And I would imagine that that's why Krishna says in chapter 15, Yatanto yoginashtainam pasyantyatman yavastitam Yatanto prakatatmano nainam pasyantyachetasa. Those who are on this path, they can see everything very clearly because they're practicing every day. If a person is not practicing every day, then he's not going to be conscious and he's not going to recognize what's going on. He won't be able to see it. These are just a few thoughts. Hearing and chanting, these are the most important aspects of bhakti. We know from Srimad Bhagavatam, bhakti has 9 chief angas, or divisions. The first one is hearing, and we mentioned this earlier, that if you look at statistics and consider those things important, the one verse that Srila Prabhupada spoke on more than any other in the Bhagavad Gita is chapter 7, text 1, in which Krishna encourages Arjuna, just listen, just hear. Mm-hmm. I saw a bumper sticker in Texas that said, shut up and dance. I thought that's a good one for the devotees. But one thing that I personally learned from His Grace Gopi Paradandana Prabhu, my elder godbrother, who is a consummate scholar and devotee, is that really, I mean, he wouldn't put it so brusquely himself. He was too much a gentleman, but, you know, the purport of what he was emphasizing in his teaching of the Srimad Bhagavatam is that we really need to just shut up and listen. That's called Jnana Tapasa in chapter 4, text number 10. Bahavo jnana tapasa puta madbhavam agata. When we're purified by that process, then we get to approach bhava bhakti. Bhava bhakti means real love. Love. Love is applicable to Krishna, mainly. And it is applicable to others as well, but only in relationship to Krishna. Otherwise, it becomes a mutual exploitation of some sort. A lot of things to consider here. I'll stop right now, and if there's any questions or any comments, please.
Some Mayavadis really like kirtan. And you may see a group of Mayavadis chanting kirtan, you may see a group of devotees chanting kirtan. But what kind of knowledge is required to discern one from the other in the first blush if you can?
Well, for one thing, we want to, I mean, the devotional service is, in a sense, it's invisible because it's the pivot which makes something either devotional service or karma or jnana, as the case may be, is invisible. It's one's motive and one's, maybe also one's realization, one's what we call sambandha jnana, one's understanding of what is the fundamental relationship between myself and the Supreme and other living entities. So if we hear what these people speak, then we can quickly understand that whether their goal is actually something else, because their sambandha jnana will be evident when they speak. Srila Prabhupada actually said pretty bluntly that a fool looks like a pundit until he speaks. And then you understand he's just a Ponga pundit. So, you know, one way is to understand, is to hear what they say, but that's not really advisable. Because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also said Mayavada shunile hoy sharbanash. Everything will be destroyed in bhakti if you hear from such persons. So it's not really advisable. But you can tell by some subtle symptoms, I suppose. Are they wearing tilak? Tilak is meant to demonstrate that I've dedicated this body to the Supreme Lord. If a person doesn't wear tilak, it means at least he's not that dedicated. Or are they chanting Durga, Durga, and whatever, with the same enthusiasm that they're chanting Krishna, Krishna, or Ram, Ram? That's another thing. If they have the misconception that they're all the same, this is another major characteristic of the Mayavad philosophy, because Mayavad means kevaladvaita, pure monism, pure oneness. If everything is one, then that means that Shiva and Krishna and Durga and my cat and the neighbor's wife and it's all one. So you can worship anything. There's a story that someone told about one of these Bengali characters. Because most of the incarnations and pseudo-yogis and bogus guru types, they seem to emanate from Bengal with greater regularity. I hope there are no Bengalis here. not intended as an ethnic slur of any sort, but one of them was, saw that he was taking his lunch and the dog came and stole the chapati, so he ran after it with it. Said, Prabhu, you forgot the salt. As if even the dog is God, what to speak of the Daridra Narayana philosophy. There's one doha that we hear often, Tulasi is sansara mein sabse milya bhai, jaane kis roop mein Narayana mil jaye. There's a certain logic there which is valid, but taken at face value and taken as literally true, it's pakka impersonalism. You never know who you're going to meet in what form you're going to meet Narayana. That doesn't mean that everyone is Narayana. What it does mean, as I understand it, is that sometimes the Lord will come or send a representative that, therefore we have to be very careful how we deal with others. We never know. You wanted to add something?
I just wanted to ask a question. Prabhupada said toward the end of his life, he said, actually there is nothing but Krishna. And it's not said that only once, many times, there is nothing but Krishna. And it also says that the self-realized devotee sees that this world is good as Vaikuntha. So on a certain level, there is only Krishna.
And there's one Vaishnava philosopher who emphasizes this. As a member of the Vishnu Swami Sampradaya, which he inherited in the 16th century. There's Vallabhacharya. Anybody ever heard of the Pushti Marga?
Of course, there was a contemporary of Mahaprabhu's.
Yeah, they was a good friend of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as well. But he had his own philosophy representing he interpreted that the Vishnu Swami line was teaching Shuddhadvaita. Shuddhadvaita means purified monism. That is to say that he also recognizes there's only Krishna, Vasudeva Saravamiti, you cannot deny it. It's in Bhagavad Gita as well. But his interpretation is radically different from that of Shankaracharya. Whereas Shankaracharya, as a consequence of his Kevaladvaita program, sees that everything is all one, and everything is Krishna, therefore I don't need to worship anyone because I'm also Krishna. Vallabhacharya sees it different. He says everything is Krishna in the sense that everything is Krishna's lila, and he's the Supreme Lord, and I'm a tiny servitor of his. So his Shuddhadvaita is called purified monism because it's not taken as an absolute categorical identity with the Supreme. He maintains still that we are eternal servitors of the Lord. In fact, almost all of the Vedanta Acharyas, they retain this idea. Only Shankaracharya, as I mentioned already, he's in the minority position. So, I don't know if that's answering your question. Or
that my question or her question?
Yours.
Just basically how to spot it on first blush, I guess is what I was
saying. Yeah, well...
You answered it very nicely.
Srila Prabhupada says that
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a spiritual, you know, it's like, you know, in the mundane realm, we have this concept of moral relativism. Anybody's value system is as good as anyone else's. So in spiritual life, this is what the Mayavad philosophy teaches. It teaches some sort of spiritual relativism in which, you know, any path you take, it's all fine. All roads lead to Rome, so to speak. Yatoma Tatopat, one of them actually said as much, that, you know, whatever path you take, it takes you to the same goal. Sometimes they even misinterpret Bhagavad Gita when Krishna says, for example, everyone is on my path, but that doesn't mean that it's everyone is equally advanced. Now, we have an innate, as human beings, we have an irrepressible attraction to this principle of unity, and people try to manifest that in the mundane realm. People who are social reformers or social activists of various sorts. And in spiritual life, people try to do so with equal artificiality, just by adopting what I mentioned earlier he calls leap philosophies, like Mayavad philosophy did. It's all one. Any path you take, it's as good as the other one. Whatever your God is, you worship him, and you're all going to end up in the same place. It's not like that. This is not what Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita. Why do I say this with such confidence? Krishna says, for example, that Yanti Deva Vrata Devan, if you worship the Devas, then you go to the Devas. Pitrin Yanti Pitra Vrataha, if you're a staunch bhakta of the Pitris, that's where you're going. Bhutani Yanti Bhutejya, if you're worshipping the Bhutas, then that's where you're going. And my devotees, he says, they come to me. He doesn't say they all come to me. If you're following that path, you're going where that path leads. It's not that you can go to the airport and just get on any plane and it's automatically going to take you where you want to go. It's not like that. Even in this mundane realm, it's not like that. It's also not like that in spiritual life. It depends upon the pivot of our desire. Now, the problem is that Mayavad is hard to recognize because that's the invisible pivot, as we mentioned earlier. One's motive, one's understanding, right? But, you know, one can understand by a person's actions. Is a person satatam kirtayanta, for example? This is what Krishna says. If he's a mahatma, he's always glorifying me. So, generally we see that these yogis and babas and swamis and pseudo-avatars and whatnot, they build big temples, and it's basically all about them. Because a lot of them are frankly just megalomaniacs. And I don't mean to be blasphemous, but, you know, I mean, either they're businessmen, or maybe they're honest mental speculators, or, you know, maybe they're just megalomaniacs, or they're on an immense, massive ego trip that this material world cannot fulfill. You know, they've broken out of all boundaries of, you know, anything within human society, so they have to have the ultimate God project, which is exactly what Mayavad provides. Think about it. Impersonal philosophy, especially Mayavad, which tells you that you're a God also, this is another one we hear. Aside from just impersonalism, the Mayavad stripe of impersonalism is that it tells you that you're God. And that's just what we want to hear, isn't it? Because that's why we came to this world to begin with. So if somebody's offering you a pseudo-spirit, so-called spiritual process that can fulfill the purpose for which you came into this world of bhoga, as a bhogi, then of course it's appealing. That's what explains the popularity. Really, the ultimate... the ultimate end of bhoga, the desire for karma, fruit of its selfish activity in this world, it can only be Mayavad, because it's the ultimate God project. One entertains the concept seriously, that he's God or that she's God. And the ultimate escape is maybe we see, I mean, Buddhism is so popular now because, you know, after all, there's no authority. Because there's no God. There's not even a soul. And, you know, there's plenty of peace. if, because people, you know, what person in today's very pungent, fast-paced, sinful world, full of all the reactions of the kind of lifestyles that we lead, well, what kind of person doesn't need some time out to just some nirvana, some shanti, right? Generally, we see that the impersonal past, they are going to emphasize these things, either shanti or the ultimate spiritual ambition of becoming God. But Krishna's out of the picture. You start pushing on Krishna a little too hard, and you see these people become very rabid very quickly. That's how you can recognize. Let's chant exclusively Krishna Kirtan tonight, folks. No, we're not doing that. You're creating duality. That's my thought. I mean, it's very subtle, so it's a hard question to answer, and you know, especially for those who are not experienced. You had something to add?
Yeah, I do have a question. Sorry, this is not going to come out easily, I'm sure. When I'm with devotees, we see devotees always, they're listening and they're nodding, yes, 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 they're saying, I know, and Mahatapa gave me the Sanskrit, and if you have it, please say it onto my recorder. He says in Sanskrit, it actually is, you say you see, but you actually do not see, so you actually do not see it. What is it?
Well, there's one verse in the Bhagavad, and actually there's many verses that phrase it this way, that pashyanna pina pashyati, even though seeing, he doesn't see. That's how it is, and that's why Krishna says, even though trying to execute this yoga practice, they don't see how they're entangled in the material nature, and therefore they can't see how to get out, and therefore they don't. Now the problem is that we're also in that category. If we're influenced at all by Mahamaya, we have to retain a little bit of humility, because this thing applies to us as well. Is that you, something further to?
So then within Prabhupada's movement, because as we can see, and I've been to India and traveled extensively, I mean, there are so many movements. But it seems we're losing track of, in Prabhupada's movement, you know, how Prabhupada wanted it to be preached, that we somehow have come to this, and I love being in Vrindavan. This is my favorite things about being in Vrindavan, because you sit in ISKCON in Vrindavan, and we don't hear this garbage. We hear, like, speaking up against this. But heavily about how in ISKCON we've turned into this, like, we think that we can speak better than Prabhupada did. And we can word his words better than Prabhupada did. And even under his own devotees, his own disciples, they're doing this, speaking his words as if they know what Prabhupada meant to say better than Prabhupada explained it in his books. And somehow Prabhupada didn't write the right words. And they know how to explain it to us better than Prabhupada did himself.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I have that tendency.
I'll try
to work on it.
No. You did very nicely.
Give me some advice, and then I'll try to follow it.
No. You did very nicely. You're quoting lots of Shastra, and you're repeating what Prabhupada wanted, and how Prabhupada said it. And, I mean, it goes as far as we were speaking yesterday, that Prabhupada wrote, when we get to these elevated platforms, how we keep preaching, you know, what our guru gave us to preach.
Well, it's always important to be a humble servant. And to be a humble servant means to faithfully carry out what the master has asked for. That's what we have to try to do. I mean, as I mentioned a minute ago, that, you know, all of us are covered by Maya to one degree or another. And therefore, all of us have to recognize that I might be mistaken. The Jains have a very nice idea. I mean, not that I'm endorsing their philosophical conclusions at all, but it's a very neat, logical category that we can appropriate from them for this purpose. It's called Syadvad. Syat, of course, is a potentive verb, means it might be, and Vad, of course, means that, you know, that's their understanding, that's the ideology that they espouse. So, you know, one has to retain a certain degree of healthy respect for the possibility that somebody else might know what they're talking about, and that, you know, conversely, that implies that maybe I don't know everything so much. And, you know, I make mistakes. Sometimes I don't do things even when I know that I should do them, or vice versa. I do things that I know I shouldn't do it, so I'm a cheater to that degree. Yeah, I have imperfect senses. I mean, I have these defects. one has to keep that in mind always. And that's why we accept spiritual masters, because when we lose track of that fact, then the spiritual master doesn't. And he more often than not is capable of putting us in our place. Radhika Mataji, you wanted to add something?
I just wanted to say that we should always think, first of all, that the mistakes are mine and I'm not seeing properly. If we think everybody's talking nonsense and they're all puffed up and crazy and trying to usurp Prabhupada, what does that say about me? Yeah. But if I start looking at myself, then maybe I'm safe. And only when you look at yourself are you going to be safe. As soon as you throw arrows, you are unsafe, because you're fault-finding everybody.
Mm.
So better find fault with myself. If you also find fault with me, I'm very happy.
That's
because right. This will give me the idea to look at myself, and you're doing me a favor. So tell me my faults. But if you think everybody's, if you, of other, or if I would think everybody's full of fault, believe me, the splinter is in my eye.
Atmavan manyate jagat, Chanakya Pandit says.
Can I tell one fault, Maldi?
Yes?
You don't give enough classes.
Chanakya Pandit says this, Atmavan manyate jagat. As we are conditioned, we assume that everybody else has the same, and it's not like that. There are some people who are phenomenally enlightened. Now, I mentioned a moment ago, we don't want to misinterpret this doha that I quoted. Na jane kisru men narayan mil jaye. Now, here's where it does apply. You don't know, I mean, he's not necessarily Narayan, of course, but you don't know what kind of devotees we're dealing with, because this bhakti is invisible.
That is the point.
It's invisible. And it pivots around one's own motive, and you cannot judge that. To some degree, we can get very close. That's what that's why I think Krishna in chapter 6 says, Atma upam yena sarvatra samam pasyati yorjana sukham yadivadukham sa yogi paramomata. I think the best yogi, Arjuna, is the person who is able to empathize. And because that person can realize that, you know, this person is, I mean, where another person is coming from. And he can appreciate what another person's qualifications are. And especially with a Vaishnava, you know, we know from so many sources that the characteristic of a Vaishnava is that he sees flaws in himself, but sees only qualities in others.
Nothing. He says he sees everybody as a pure devotee except himself. That is the first class.
That's the Uttama Adhikari, but even the Madhyama Adhikari, he exercises a fair degree of humility and introspection, such that he actually comes into this mood. I mean, a Madhyama Adhikari is actually enjoined to discriminate, and in today's society, discrimination is a bad word. But discrimination is necessary, but one, that discrimination has to be tempered by an awareness of the fact that I've got defects that are clouding my own vision.
And Guru and Shastra and Acharya.
This is why we accept Guru, because a Guru is the one who arbits the meaning of Shastra. And a Guru is the one who represents the Parampara. Nobody's independent here. So, but my point is this, that we don't know who we're dealing with. A person came maybe in Nitya Siddha and looked like a pukka pound shilling pence man. Ihayasya harirdasya karmana manasa gira nikala shvapyavasthasu jivan mukta sochyate. Rupa Goswami says, he looks like an ordinary pound shilling pence man, but if his only business is to serve Krishna with body, mind, and words, that person is jivan mukta. Just like they look like ordinary Muslims, even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's personal servant, when Sanatan Goswami came to join him at Kashi, he said, oh, there's nobody outside your door but one dervish is there. He thought, you know, Ras Khan, you want to hear a really colorful story? In the Chaurasi Vaishnavan Ki Varta, this is a hagiography of the Vallabh Sampradaya in Brijbhasha language, there's a story of Ras Khan. Ras Khan was a Pathan, obviously a Muslim. This is in the 16th century. And not only was he a Pathan, but he was, I mean, there's no polite word for it, he was a pervert. And he was following around this Hindu boy that he had fallen in love with. That was his mood. And so some Vaishnavas one day they were talking, and they said they all had a picture of Srinathji, the Gopal deity that Madhavendra Puri installed at Govardhan. And they were looking at this picture and said, we should become so attached to Srinathji as that Ras Khan is to that boy. Now Ras Khan was in earshot of this, so he pulls out his talwar, his sword, because, you know, they carry such things. And he says, what were you saying about me? The Vaishnavas all started to tremble, and he said, no, we were just admiring that you have the kinds of qualities that we would like to develop. And he said, well, let me see, who is this Srinathji that you're talking about? So the Vaishnava showed him his Chitraseva, they call it, a deity in the form of a picture. In the 16th century, you never knew. The political situation was so unstable that at any moment you may have to flee your house on a second's notice. So devotees used to just, instead of a deity, they used to worship a picture, and sometimes they even used to carry them in their pagri, tucked into the folds of the turban. So the one devotee had his picture there, and he showed him. This picture shows Srinathji in the summer months when they dress him with almost nothing on, just like, you know, maybe a gamsha or some kopin or something very... So Ras Khan saw this picture. You can understand his mentality. He saw this picture, and he became irrepressibly attached instantly, and he thought, where does he live? I've got to find him. The Vaishnavas are thinking, oh my God, what now? So they said, no, he lives in Vrindavan. So Ras Khan said, okay, I'm going. And immediately he left, the very day he left. And he took the Vaishnavas, he took his Chitraseva with him. When he's got a sword, what can you do? So anyway, he went to Vrindavan, and he's going from one temple to the next. He's looking at the picture, looking at the deity. No, not this one. He goes on to the next. Process of elimination. Finally, he comes to Govardhan Hill. There's the last temple that he's not seen yet on top of Govardhan Hill. Anyone here ever been to Govardhan? Giriraj, raise your hand. Giriraj Maharaj ki.
Yeah.
So there's near the above Govinda Kund, there's a temple still is there. It has a couple of pyramids on top. Old temple that was built by Madhavendra Puri. Later on, the Vallabha Sampradaya took charge of the temple. But he saw all these pilgrims are going up there. So he thought, well, I'll go along with them. When he came to this temple, he was going on along with all the pilgrims. He thought, they'll let me in, I'll take darshan, and we'll see what happens. And so then, all the pilgrims were able to get in, but when Ras Khan's turn came to go through the door, a big arm came down and stopped him. He looks up and sees a couple of chokidars are there. You can't get in. You're Muslims. No Muslims allowed. Because he was dressed so obviously. He was a Pathan. So he thought, oh, Krishna, what to do now?
Krishna.
So he went down at the bank of Govinda Kund, and he sat there for 3 days. He didn't eat anything. He didn't sleep. He just was in anxiety. He put his face in his hands. This is the typical representation when one is depressed in Vedic literature. He put his head in his hands and just mulled over it. Meanwhile, Krishna within the heart, because he's within everyone's heart, even within the Patan's heart, within the heart of the super soul, Krishna recognized. And then the Acharya of that Sampradaya in those days, his name was Vitalesh Goswami, the son of Vallabha Acharya. He was, meanwhile, in Gokula, where they had the seat of their Sampradaya in those days. He was taking rest, as all Brahmins do, after lunch, with the left side down. So, in his dream, Srinathji came and said, listen, you need to wake up right now, go to Govardhan. There's a Daivi Jiva there. He's waiting for you to give him initiation because he wants to serve me. But I don't accept service from anyone unless he's got a sponsor in the form of a spiritual master. So you have to go and initiate him. He's a Daivi Jiva, how should we say, means he's a very elevated soul. He's not ordinary, mundane, conditioned soul. So he did that. He got on his horse and he went over to Govardhan. It's not that far. So when he came to Govardhan, sure enough, Ras Khan is sitting there, this Patan is sitting there at the foot of, on the bank of Govinda Kund with his head in his hand still. He looks up and sees this person coming on a horse, and he had some intuition. We call it intuition. Shastra calls it Paramatma. Within the heart, told him that, you know, inquire from this person. So he thought, this person is coming. I can get something from him. So he approached Vitalesh Goswami very respectfully. He said, Prabhuji, wahan mere mehpool rehte hain. Means that, you know, I don't want to translate it, but you understand what it means. He said, please, I want to meet that person. That's what he's the idea. So Vitalesh said, yes, first you take your bath and put on these clean clothes and this tulasi necklace, and then come and see me. So he did that, and then he gave him the initiation. And then Ras Khan went up to the temple at that time. He says, now I have to go and wake the deity and make an offering. And when finished, then the arati will be there, and then when all the pilgrims come into the arati, you can join them as well. So he said, Hanji. And then when the conch shell blew, then Ras Khan went up again. All the pilgrims went. He went with them. This time, nobody stopped him. He was a Vaishnava, he was initiated, he got into the temple. When he saw the darshan of Srinathji, he went into complete ecstasy. Spontaneously, he started to sing so many songs of his own composition in Brij Bhasha language. He's one of the greatest poets of Brij Bhasha, Ras Khan, even though he was a Muslim before, but he was actually a devotee. And, for example, he sang, Duri Bharayeti Ati Sobhita Syamaju Tesi Bani Sira Sundara Choti Kela Takata Fire Angana Paga Paijani Bajati Piri Kachoti Wa Chabiko Rasakana Bilokata Varta Kama Kalani Dhikoti Kag Ke Bhag Kahakahiye Harihata Son Le Gayo Makara Roti. Means that this little boy is running around in his courtyard, and you know how children are when they're that age. He's not eating and he's not playing, but he's doing both at the same time. Takes them forever to eat because they can't focus. They get off task so easily. So Krishna was exhibiting this pastime with chapati in his hand. And how is he dressed? He's got yellow bagal bandi. His mother has done his top knot so nicely with pearls and peacock feather. He's got nupur or pile on his feet. Ankle bracelets are jingling nicely. He's got a little belt also. A tiger claw necklace around his neck. Beautiful, beautiful complexion. So much so, Ras Khan thinks that when I see this form, I think 1,000 cupids, they're instantly vanquished by this beauty. So then what can I say about the good fortune of that crow who suddenly swooped down and took the chapati out of his hand? He wasn't eating it. You use it or lose it, as they say. So he had this insight. And he said, what else? He said, Shesha Ganesha Dinesa Mahesa Suresa Hujahi Nirantara Gawain. Okay, say, Adi Anadi Ananta Akhanda Achanda Abheda Subheda Batawe. We were talking about impersonalism. This is how it works. Usually you hear these terms. Vague, indirect, non-personal description of the absolute truth. What is that? I lost my train. Narad son sukavyasara taipa chihari ta upuni parna pave tahi ahira kicho hariyang chachiabhari chachapai nachana chave. That means that even though the great demigods Sheshanaga and Mahesh means Lord Shiva, Indra, Dinesh, Surya, you know, so many demigods and sages, they're all praising him and worshipping with awe and reverence since time immemorial. How are they doing so? They're describing him in the Upanishads. Adi, the beginningless one. Anadi, with no beginning. Ananta, unlimited. Via negativa, not this, not that, right? Achanda, indescribable, ineffable. Abheda, non-dual, that's a favorite one. Or Advaita means the same thing. In this way, they're going on like this. Narad is receiving this thing from his spiritual master. He's giving the same thing to Vyasadeva. Shukdev gets it from him. It's coming down in Paramparaya, and yet even these great devotees and sages, they cannot describe the further extent of his glory. So then what about these gopis? What power do they have that when they ask Krishna, Krishna, if you dance, we'll give you a little bit of chach, buttermilk. And Krishna has to start doing it. He starts to dance. They're able to make him dance. So Ras Khan, he had this insight. Somehow or other, he was one of Krishna's eternal associates. He just appeared in this form. But the point that we're making tonight is that anybody can come in any form, you don't know. Shall I tell you one more story and then we have to end?
Yes.
There is in, I'm not going to mention any names, but there's one devotee that I know. And he was, before he joined ISKCON, he was a very staunch worshipper of Lord Shiva. Very Pakka Shaiva worshipper. I mean, every day he was doing puja early in the morning, and he was reading Shiva Purana religiously every single day. He was really, really devoted in this way. He was a real Hindu, not these pseudo washed up Hindus that you come across. But one day he read in the Shiva Purana, because he was ardently praying for guidance for his spiritual advancement. He was praying for a spiritual master. So one day he read in the Shiva Purana that Lord Shiva was instructing one of his followers that you may even be surprised to find that you meet your spiritual master among your enemies. And so now at this time, this was when ISKCON was fairly new to Fiji, which is where he's from, Fiji Islands in the South Pacific. And you know how ISKCON is. Wherever we go, we put up the loudspeakers and make we just start putting out, and people get irritated. So there was some lawsuit about that. And he's an attorney, and so he was actually the attorney hired by the local residents who felt disturbed by the noise of the ISKCON temple and the hubbub and the cars and all that ISKCON brought to the neighborhood. So one day his friend also said, listen, I've been going to this Hare Krishna temple. It's actually very nice. Why don't you come and join me one day for the Sunday? They have an open house. I think you'll like it. You're a very religious man. Come with me. He said, no, you don't understand. I'm fighting these people in court. How can I go there? What will they think? So anyway, somehow or other, his friend convinced him, no, you have to, please, it's okay. It'll be all right. So somehow he went, and he made sure that he sat way in the back. Now, when he went there that day, Tamal Krishna Goswami was speaking there, and he was listening very attentively, because he's an intelligent man, also very sincere, and he was really, he found that it's the person who's very reasonable, very made a good impression on him. And, he noticed that some of the local managers who were with him, they started looking at him nervously. He said, they spotted me now, what am I going to do? So he kind of remained low-key, and they went that day. But then they came back later, and he began to attend the temple regularly, and eventually he actually became a little bit attracted by ISKCON. He met Tamal Krishna Goswami, and somehow, I don't know how the court case resolved, but somehow it did resolve. And eventually he became a devotee in the temple, congregational member. And it went further than that. Ultimately, he ended up taking spiritual initiation from Tamal Krishna Goswami. And that person is now serving as the temple president in Dallas, Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's a GBC.
Yeah.
So the point is that you never know. He may look like a Shaiva, or he may look like a Patan, or he may look like a hippie, or whatever. But the Daivi Jivas are out there, and that's why we just need to broadcast Krishna consciousness as much as possible in the form of the holy name, especially in the form of Srila Prabhupada's books, but most importantly in the form of our own character. And when people see that, then they're hungry. We were talking earlier. There are so many people who do not join ISKCON. Why? It's not just because they're insincere, it's because we're insincere.
Exactly.
And we need to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I know I'm rambling now, so I'll stop here. But unless there's anything else, thank you very much for listening
very
patiently.
Thank you very much.
Okay.